The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Tuesday, March the 2nd, and let the record reflect that there is a quorum present. Members, we're going to start out with Senate File 2453 first of the two Carlson bills, and then we'll move into 639. Senator Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to present Senate File 2453, which is a bill that allows bicycles to, after a time when they've reached the red light, to treat it as a stop sign. Lights, left turn signals are often triggered by the presence of a body of either metal or some other mass. If you probably think about these lights, there's often a circle or a hexagon that's sawed into the street, and there's a coil of wire that's in there, and that senses when a body parks over it. And that's what triggers the light to give you either a through signal or a left turn signal. And in the case of a motorcycle, sometimes the motorcycles don't have enough mass to be able to trigger that light. And so what we've done in the past is to change statute and put in there that if a motorcycle waits for a reasonable amount of time through a cycle, that then they can treat that red light as a stop sign and proceed with caution. With the bill 2453, we're going to do that same thing with a bicycle. There are a lot of people that ride bicycles, they commute with bicycles, and they will not be able to go through a intersection that's controlled by one of these intelligent semaphores unless they can trigger it. And what we're saying is that if you park on that trigger, that proximity sensor, we call it in engineering language, and the light still doesn't turn, you can treat that light as a stop sign, and you can proceed with caution when there's no traffic. The reason that I'm here before you today is that we did have an amendment that was added to this bill that is that affects this particular committee, and that is it sets a sunset for the entire clause, and what that does is that will sunset also the affirmative defense for even motorcycles. And we would prefer that not be on there. And we would like to bring the bill back to its clean language that it was in the past. And what I have here is I have Mr. Dorian Grilly from the Bicycle Alliance that can give you any testimony if you'd like on the use of commuter bikes and any kind of sensitivity that you'd like on riding bicycles on the street.
Mr. Dorian, I'm not a bicyclist. Sometimes my feet doesn't reach the pedals for the grown-up bikes, and it hurts my dignity to have to ride a little kid's bike. So talk to us a little bit about, I mean, I had never heard about this until we encountered this bill. But what is it like when you're riding your bike and you come to the cross section and the lights just won't turn green?
Well, the Bicycle Alliance is a new statewide bicycle nonprofit, bicycling organization, and we're passionate about bicycling and following the rules of the road. So one of our programs is to educate bicyclists to follow the rules of the road, which means signaling, using left turn lanes where appropriate. And in the Transportation Committee, we had a gentleman testify who rides from Edina to downtown Minneapolis every day, and he goes through 14 traffic signals, and half of them he can't trigger when he's in the left turn lane, the loop detector or the sensor Senator Carlson was talking about. So what that does is it leaves you hanging out there in the middle of an intersection with cars whizzing by on both sides. The other thing that's I think of critical importance here is it inconveniences a motorist that comes up behind you, and you aren't able to trigger the signal. And I've been in a left turn lane and ask motorists to come up close. You know, I pull up into the crosswalk and ask a motorist to come up, and they look at you like you're a little crazy. You know, maybe they're being Minnesota nice, but they don't come close enough to trigger the signal. So that's the story. The Bicycle Alliance would, I think this simple change would improve conditions for all vehicle drivers and certainly make it safer for bicyclists.
Senator Carlson, what is it about the sunsetting of the affirmative defense that that concerns you?
Well, I think the first thing is that it is a sunset of the entire clause, including the motorcycle language, and it does the clause, or let's say the statute, gives you the affirmative defense if you are stopped after going through a light that does not change. And what I think what interests this committee is that we are eliminating that affirmative defense.
Chair Moa, can I make a quick comment?
Sure, Mr.
I believe it was inappropriately added in a rush in the Transportation Committee when they were talking about, is there technology that can solve this problem? Yes, there is technology that can solve this problem, but it would require retrofitting thousands of intersections, probably at the cost of millions of dollars. And I don't think that's realistic to be done in 3 years, okay, or 5 years, or even 10.
Members, there's an A2 amendment in your packets that deletes the sunsetting provision of the affirmative defense.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, I was going to offer that. Is that?
It's appropriate now. Would you like to move that?
I would.
Senator Shy moves the A2 amendment. Any discussions on the A2 amendment? Is there anybody here who would like to either testify for or against the A2 amendment removing the sunset provision? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid moves.
I'm sure.
Senator Lemmer.
Before we go further, I wanted to ask Senator Carlson a question. Right now, motorcyclists can kind of take a more relaxed way through an intersection that may have a red light if they're turning. And what you're doing in this bill, is that affecting that law in any way?
It's adding to
it. It no longer
Senator
does.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, it no longer does, because what we had was an amendment that would delete that ability for motorcyclists to do it. The motorcycle permissiveness was already in the law, and we're adding bicycles to it.
All right.
So it has no effect on motorcycles.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
And Madam Chair, one of these days we'll get to let cars do it. But not yet. Not yet.
Well, wait, if that is a foreshadowing of your bill, Senator Scheid.
No, Madam Chair. No,
Madam
not
Chair.
This year.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, there's a certain intersection about five blocks away from my house that I can't get my Chevy Suburban through. It doesn't trigger the light either. And so, no, I won't bring that amendment up right now.
Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 2453 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Dorian.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson, Senate File 639.
Oh, my God.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 639 would apply, and it affects the penalties for careless disregard of a motor vehicle that does not have another statute broken at the time of this careless disregard, and being involved in an accident that causes a death. At the present time, there's no difference between a accident that causes the death of a person and an accident that just causes property damage. And what we wanted to do was have an enhanced penalty for those situations where careless regard actually resulted in the death of a person. So we're adding the portion which says anyone who operates a motor vehicle in careless disregard for the safety of others and causes a death, that this careless disregard could be punishable by a gross misdemeanor. And I have with me to help testify, I have Mr. Scott Hershey from the Dakota County Attorney's Office, and also Nancy Johnson with Minnesotans for Safe Driving.
Who would like to start?
Mr. Hershey.
Mr. Hershey, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
My name is Scott Hersey. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney and head of the criminal division in that office. And we are asking the committee to consider passing this bill because we feel that the existing statute of careless driving just is inadequate to answer for the death of a loved one. The current statute, careless driving, is a misdemeanor, and that does carry a maximum penalty of up to 90 days in jail or a $1,000 fine, and it carries 1 year probation. We are seeking a gross misdemeanor penalty. That does carry up to a $3,000 fine or 1 year in jail, but it carries a double probationary period of 2 years. And when someone has had a family member killed, we have met with the family members, and it's very difficult to explain to the family members why the law doesn't have something to account for this. This is usually a non-alcohol-related situation where someone has driven irresponsibly, but enough so that someone else has been killed. And we have explained to the family that we will try to bring to the legislature's attention the need to enact a gross misdemeanor in this case. And this does not have any mandatory minimum associated with it. It simply gives a judge options to sentence appropriately. The range of conduct may be quite broad here, and it gives the judge the various options. A judge may want a longer probationary period of 2 years. The judge may want a larger fine and make that payable over time to remind the offender of the seriousness of the conduct. And the judge may want time to get treatment programs done, like an anger management program, a driver improvement clinic, or maybe even some psychological treatment. It may be that a judge wants to make sure that the person is law-abiding by suspending the full year over the person. But this law would give the judge all of those various options. And we feel it's important to stress that we're not talking about accidents here. We are talking about a misdemeanor. We're talking about careless driving, where someone drives carelessly or heedlessly in disregard of the safety of others. They're driving without that standard of care that a reasonable driver would exercise in the same circumstances. And we feel that if someone runs a stop sign and they make the decision to run a stop sign or a red light at a significant speed and they kill someone, the judge needs to have significant options to deal with that. And I might note, and we've been asked before, well, why should the outcome of a particular crime determine the level of that crime? We do that in many other statutes. We do that in assaults. First-degree assault involving great bodily harm is a 20-year felony. Third-degree assault with substantial bodily harm is a 5-year felony. Fourth-degree assault on a peace officer with demonstrable bodily harm is a 3-year felony. And fifth-degree assault with some bodily harm is a misdemeanor. We also have categories of injuries in criminal vehicular operation. We also even apply those to the animal cruelty statutes. And, in fact, we do have a manslaughter statute that normally deals with a misdemeanor, but if a misdemeanor is committed under circumstances that shows great force and violence, that death is reasonably foreseeable, that elevates the offense to a felony. So there are other statutes that do, in fact, deal with increasing the penalty because of the level of the offense. And these are actual elements. We will have to prove the severity of the injury beyond a reasonable doubt to all of the jurors on the jury. We have been asked, well, why don't you use the criminal vehicular homicide statute? There is one category that would deal with this type of situation in crim vehicular homicide, but the standards is extremely high for a non-alcohol-related offense, and that requires gross negligence, which the courts have defined as extremely great negligence without even scant care. The Minnesota Supreme Court back in 2005 said even falling asleep at the wheel and being unconscious at the time of the accident is not sufficient for the high standard for gross negligence for criminal vehicular homicide. So we are asking the committee to consider passing a gross misdemeanor crime, careless driving resulting in death. Thank you.
Mr. Hersey, the careless driving or carelessly or heedlessly, you said that's not a gross negligence.
Correct.
So what level is that?
If one drove grossly negligently and they injured someone or they killed someone, that can be, if it's simply bodily injury, that's a gross misdemeanor. If they drove grossly negligently and severely injured someone, either substantial or great bodily harm, that's a felony. If they kill someone, again, that is a felony.
But isn't carelessly or heedlessly a simple negligence standard?
It is negligence proven beyond a reasonable doubt. It's failure to exercise the care that a reasonable person would exercise under the same circumstances.
I understand that, Mr. Hersey, but the fact of the matter is that we're not proving the injuries. The injuries or the consequences is kind of the prima facie result. The proof here is the carelessly and the heedlessly.
Correct.
Isn't it, Mr. Hersey?
That's true.
And so isn't it departing from what we have in the statutes to take something that's a simple negligence standard and making that a gross misdemeanor?
Well, from our perspective and from talking to many, many victims and looking at similar statutes where we have increased the penalty based on the injury, we feel it's appropriate. Careless driving is not simply someone that's speeding. It's not someone who's violating a petty misdemeanor traffic law. But when they violate the law, according to what the jury determines, beyond a reasonable doubt, with such a disregard of the standard of care that a reasonable person would use, that is careless driving. And we're simply asking that the existing statute have a gross misdemeanor associated when there's death involved.
So, Mr. Hersey, can you give us some examples of what that might be?
If a person perhaps runs a red light and they go through it at the speed limit, that may not necessarily be careless driving. If a person runs a red light and they're 500 feet away and they gun it to try and get through there and they increase their speed, certainly that's careless driving. And if they hit someone and kill them, that's the type of situation we would ask it to apply to. A simple traffic accident where no one's at fault, but two people happen to have their vehicles coming together at the same time, that is an accident. That is not careless or heedlessly in disregard of the rights of others.
But that's not what the statute language says, Mr. Hersey.
Well, the statutory language in the past has been interpreted significantly by the appellate courts. And they have said that it is negligence, but it's negligence that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And any time we will have a statute such as this, which we already have, there are many cases interpreting this, you will have interpretations by the court. And the courts will look at the jury verdicts, and they will make their decisions as to where the cases fall. Is this careless driving? Is this not careless driving? And they have looked at numerous factual situations, and they've described what is careless driving, what is not. They've said that even a semi-failure to examine the brakes, the results in the brakes failing, that is not enough for careless driving or, in fact, a criminal vehicular operation involving gross negligence.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Chair, may I ask, you know, and I should be looking, I suppose, in Chapter 169, but does texting fall in to careless driving, or is it any place else?
Mr. Hersey.
Senator, Madam Chair, texting has not been defined in the statutes as careless driving. There's a specific statute that deals with texting by younger people, but that does not fall within the definition of careless driving as it's currently defined.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
So, Madam Chair, could that be found here? I mean, could, if a person was texting?
Yeah.
That,
Mr. Hersey?
Madam Chair, Senator, it would depend on the circumstances. If a person were doing that and paying no attention to where they were driving and spending their time using some device to text, that could be a situation where they were driving carelessly and took the risk that they would injure or kill someone else. Because careless driving is something where a person driving a 3,000-pound vehicle or greater needs to pay attention to what they're doing. And if they are disregarding the safety of others with a very serious activity, an adult activity, the law takes account of that.
But Mr. Hersey, that's you sitting here defining from situation to situation whether it's careless driving or not. Our concern is that this is a general statute that's going to be given to the courts to apply, and neither you or us are going to be there to say in this circumstance it's not careless driving, this circumstance it's not. And so it's not so much, I think, proving of the injuries or proving something beyond a reasonable doubt. Isn't it a fact that carelessly or heedlessly, though, it's extremely hard to prove?
It is, and there are standard jury instructions, Madam Chair, that judges give to juries, and there's one specifically on careless driving, and it's standardized throughout the state. It's in the Minnesota Jury Instruction Guide's criminal, and we do have to show to the jury satisfaction, beyond a reasonable doubt, that this was careless driving that endangered someone else. And like I say, the judges have seen, the appellate judges have seen many, many decisions, and they have made rulings on whether something is or is not careless driving. But ultimately, because of this definition, it's up to the jury. And we've had careless driving for the past 30 years as a misdemeanor, and there have been many decisions by the courts as to what is careless driving and what isn't. Ultimately, it comes down to what the citizens decide, and that's essentially how our jury system works.
Well, because careless driving, I think it's a is ordinary negligence. That's why it's a misdemeanor. But in this situation, you're asking for it to become a gross misdemeanor, and I think that's a public policy discussion for us in the committee. Senator Foley and then Senator Betzel. Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm concerned, too, with the way this comes out. It seems to me that every time we get something that is a little different, and usually where it arises is that the parent or relative of some sort is grieved because their child or person was injured, and there's no showing that this is going to continue or it's more than one limited thing. Tell me how many cases that you would find in a alcohol-involved careless driving that would be otherwise different than what's currently in statute.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hersey.
Senator, are you talking about non-alcohol-related careless driving, Senator?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
And Mr. Hersey, that I would take that both ways because it's just a matter of looking at how that would play out. Basically, when you're looking at careless driving, you're talking about carelessly and heedlessly. It's a much lower standard than reckless driving, which is a willful and wanton act. And I would like to know what you perceive would be the number of cases that you dealt with. And the other thing, I know it's wrong to ask two questions at one time, but nonetheless, looking at what the state alcohol task force would put in there.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Senator, Hersey?
I don't know if I can answer the latter part of your question, Senator, as to the state alcohol task force, presumably the DWI task force, but we could certainly check with them. But we do have periodically some of these cases where it's not alcohol-related and it's careless driving that results in death. One was one that we had in Farmington. I believe that was last year, where a nurse had worked two shifts, double shifts, on two different dates, had fallen asleep on the way home, and she had hit a young woman on the side of the road. She simply fell asleep and ran down the young woman who was caring for the flowers on the side of the road in Farmington. We had another situation where a woman had a problem with her carburetor. She was driving. That went on for about 12 minutes. She was on the line with a 911 operator, but did not take the steps that were advised to shut off her car or put the car in neutral or use the emergency brake, things of that nature. She struck a motorcyclist when she went through an intersection. And we recently have a case that's under investigation involving a juvenile, and we don't have the full results of that investigation. It's being investigated by the State Patrol, where a juvenile struck three victims and killed them. Again, that was not alcohol-related. We get these periodically. And like I say, we meet with the families and we go over the law and we go over what we can do with these cases, but generally they're simply ones where we can proceed with careless driving but nothing else.
Senator, but
if I just to finish your question, Senator, if there's alcohol involved, then it may be a situation where it's criminal vehicular homicide. If we can show that either the person was under the influence of alcohol or they had a reading of 0.08 or more. Most of the cases that we're talking about here are non-alcohol related at all.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if this question has been asked, I apologize, but I've had some concerns about the proportionality and making sure that the statutes are consistent. And maybe this is a question more for Senate Counsel. There's a difference, obviously, between reckless driving and careless driving. Reckless driving, if, as I understand it, is where you have somebody that's just, as Senator Foley indicated, wanton and willful disregard. Somebody's driving way too fast for the weather conditions, as an example. Just reckless driving, which could result in death, as opposed to careless driving, where somebody, you know, is not quite paying attention, they're distracted, or they're on the cell phone, whatever it is, but it doesn't quite rise to the level of reckless driving. My questions, concerns are, would this bill now, how is this bill would relate to reckless driving resulting in death, or, you know, how would that, how would those two statutes mesh? Would it be the same penalty? What is it?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, technically speaking, the bill doesn't affect the reckless driving charge, which is under subdivision one of that same statute, which is, again, seems to be a higher standard, but it's also a misdemeanor. And that's something that really is primarily in the jurisdiction of the Transportation Committee, and we've never quite dealt with it. But it's always somewhat confused me that you have reckless driving and careless driving, and they're both misdemeanors. But this one affects just careless. As Mr. Hershey mentioned, we do have statutes on criminal vehicular homicide and injury, and that, if you're not drinking, that requires gross negligence. So that's not a reckless standard. It's a gross negligence standard, and I believe that's a 10-year felony if it results in death, where this would be careless, which was ordinary negligence, basically, which would be a gross misdemeanor if it results in death.
So Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Just to clarify, because as I say, we don't have, this bill does not address reckless driving. So by adopting this, we theoretically could have a more serious offense for careless driving than we could for reckless driving.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, well, you'd only have the more serious offense if it's careless driving that results in death. That would be the gross misdemeanor. This bill doesn't change the careless driving.
Senator Betzel?
Mr. Backus, okay, if you have reckless driving resulting in death, what's the penalty for that?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, you would have to, I believe you would have to either charge the person, if you could charge the person under the gross negligence standard of criminal vehicular homicide, which again is a 10-year felony, or I think you'd have to charge under careless driving, which would be, in this case, would be a gross misdemeanor.
And the penalty is what? Gross misdemeanor?
Under this bill, Senator Betzold, it would be careless driving resulting in death would be a gross misdemeanor.
Okay, but for reckless driving, this bill doesn't address...
It does not address reckless
driving. So the penalty for reckless driving resulting in death would be the same as careless driving resulting in death under this bill. This bill doesn't change reckless driving. So this elevates reckless driving but does not change careless driving.
Vice versa. It elevates careless driving,
does not change reckless. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and just to kind of summarize my understanding of that, then we'd kind of, in terms of elevating, we'd be elevating twice. We'd be changing, going from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor, and we'd be only having to prove careless as opposed to reckless to get there, it seems like. That would. But the question that I have, and this is kind of moving to subsection B, if we're ready for that?
Yes.
Okay. On subsection, or section B of subdivision 4, I'm not sure what this is intending exactly to get at, but where it raises red flags for me is years ago, so I haven't practiced in this area a long time, so forgive my lack of using the proper terms, perhaps. But I remember that you wanted to be careful about charging a lower level offense if there might be evidence out there of a higher level offense, because once someone has pleaded to that offense that incorporated elements, then you were, you couldn't charge them later with a higher level offense because of this constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy. And so if this is what you're dealing with here, we can't say not, if that's what this is addressing, you can't say notwithstanding any other law because we can't get around the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy. And is that the issue? Or what are you dealing with here?
Ms. Johnson, we'll come to you, but we're asking Mr. Hersey all these questions because he's the lawyer at the table.
I understand.
Mr. Hersey.
Madam Chair, Senator, the constitutional provision of double jeopardy does not come into play in this type of situation, but the Minnesota statute, which is much broader than double jeopardy, which deals with a single course of conduct, does come into play in Minnesota Statute 609.035 and 609.04. Double jeopardy is a constitutional matter, basically says that you can't be tried for the same thing twice with various theories that expand on that a little bit. Under 609.035 and 04, it basically says that a person can only be convicted of one offense within a particular course of conduct with certain exceptions. And exactly as you described it, if a person is charged with a lesser offense and a greater offense and they can somehow plead guilty to the lesser offense, that will preclude the prosecution of the greater offense. And some of those problems came into being when maybe a city attorney might charge a lesser offense and a county attorney might charge a greater, not knowing that the other had charged. The purpose of this law is to deal with situations that might come up in a similar context, but where we feel that there should be a separate crime that could be charged, such as maybe the person not only drove carelessly, but then we find out that they have no insurance. And they should be held accountable for the no insurance because the victim then can't be recompensed from their insurance. Or maybe they had a felony amount of marijuana in the car or had methamphetamine or cocaine in the car. We wanted to be able to charge those things as well. So that's the reason for the second clause.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Well, why would we want to go and kind of make an exception to a broad policy? I mean, it seems like if we were going to talk about that issue, we'd talk about it broadly. We already have kind of a policy on in statute, and I think there's it arose out of some constitutional issues in terms of the double jeopardy. Maybe it's broader. I haven't researched that. But now you're saying that in this particular circumstance, we're going to treat this differently than we
tilt
treat
up
anything
mic.
Else, and I'm not sure why we would want to do that and, instead of being consistent.
Mr. Hersey?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, 609.035, as it currently reads, has numerous exceptions in it for fleeing a peace officer, for various circumstances involving no insurance. And so while perhaps 20 years ago it used to be quite simple and it just had a flat statement in it, now it has numerous exceptions. And I think this would be consistent with the approach that has been taken in recent years to look more carefully at the single course of conduct concept, because otherwise if you took it literally, one could say, okay, you have a careless driving, whether it's amended to read resulting in death or not, then maybe you might not be able to convict the person of felony possession of heroin or some other matter like that, or if they had a firearm in the vehicle. And I think the current trend under 609.035, with the numerous exceptions that are listed in there, would show the current legislative trend is to make sure that serious offenses can't be blocked because someone may be committing some other offense. And if I may, just to get back to Senator Betzold's concern very quickly, reckless driving is driving that is done recklessly or heedlessly in disregard of the rights of others. I don't have the exact language in front of me because I don't have the statute here, but it is a higher standard. I think it's willful and wanton driving. That is a higher standard than careless driving, but the way this bill is written, anytime you would have reckless driving, you would also have careless driving. We could certainly include careless driving in here as another provision.
Reckless.
But it would seem to me that anytime we have reckless driving, we would also have the careless driving.
Senator Higgins and then Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Hersey, I mean, that gets to the concerns that I had because our criminal law statutes usually try to be proportional. Intentional misconduct is usually penalized at a higher level than, say, reckless conduct or gross negligence. Negligence is lower than gross negligence. It has less penalties. Likewise, careless driving is a lower threshold than reckless driving. If this bill is going to make the penalties for careless driving and reckless driving the same, first of all, it throws up proportionality, but and I don't think that's a very good idea, but why don't we just say that we're going to make careless and reckless driving the very same level, which makes no sense to me.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair and Mr. Hersey, I listened to what you were saying about paragraph B, but it didn't make any sense to me, and I apologize. I'm not a lawyer sitting on this committee. Because, from what I can tell, if there's an event that happens and there are multiple things that are wrong during that event, you get charged for the whole collection of them. So why would we have to have a sentence that says, notwithstanding all this stuff, you can charge all the things that happen? I mean, is this just a belt and suspender kind of thing? Is this just saying what is existing?
Mr. Hersey?
I truly just don't get it.
Madam Chair, Senator, this is a confusing area of the law, to say the least, and it's an area that has numerous cases going back to the 1960s, starting with State versus Johnson, where the courts have sort of surgically decided in certain circumstances, which I can't always reconcile, you know, what's the same course of conduct and what is not. While a person may be charged with several offenses during this whole spree or course of conduct, under 609.035, normally they're only supposed to be convicted of one of those. And the law and the statutes over time have established a number of exceptions to that because sometimes that didn't really have a just result. And so this is intended, like I say, to cover the situation where you have a careless driving with no insurance, to be able to convict on both of those. If you have the careless driving with a firearm in the vehicle, to convict on both of those. Otherwise, you may not, and you may run into a judicial decision that may say, well, we're interpreting the legislative intent, and it looks to us like the legislature said you can only convict of one offense. So if the jury convicts of perhaps four or five offenses at trial, then the judge has to decide, well, I can only sentence on one. Which one do I sentence on? And it, without this, I think there is a real legal quandary that probably hasn't been very well resolved in the case law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson and then Senator Foley.
Well, Madam Chair, again, without having just gone back and recently researched this, I think that the same course of conduct case law was based on the double jeopardy concerns in the Constitution, which was codified and has now had some exceptions built in, but there are still these underlying constitutional issues. And I don't think you can say, notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, which includes our Constitution, you know, that we can just broadly disregard the fact that there are some double jeopardy concerns, and maybe there are some circumstances where it doesn't go as far as to be a constitutional violation. But I would have to say I think your language is overly broad in the other direction, because there certainly are some circumstances where you can't just piecemeal prosecuting people for the same event. And if once you've prosecuted them, you can't necessarily come back and repeat that over and over.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Hersey?
Senator, I understand what you're saying, and you make some very good points. I think 609.035 is much broader than the constitutional protection, but obviously that a law, a statute, can't contravene either the state or the federal constitution, and this certainly is not intended to do so. But this is not the primary part of the bill, so if there happened to be an amendment that would strike Clause B, that would not significantly affect the main thrust of this bill, which is careless driving involving death. So it certainly would be workable to simply eliminate Clause B if that is a concern to the committee.
Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I look at this, and I still haven't figured out why you need this kind of legislation. It just you're talking about insurance. Frankly, in my judgment, the insurance is a civil matter and not to be made criminal, as we have done. And I'm not prepared to go forward. I think we should listen to the other witness and then take action.
Ms. Johnson.
Been interesting. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Johnson. I'm president of Minnesotans for Safe Driving, a nonprofit traffic safety and victim assistance organization. Our group is very much in support of increasing the charge for non-alcohol-related chargeable traffic crashes resulting in death. We believe that these changes in law are needed, especially for the families devastated by the senseless and sudden death of their loved ones. As a victims organization, and we meet, this becomes a little different than when you're looking purely at, each little bits of the law. This change in charging non-alcohol-related crashes is not for crashes caused by accidental behavior. I know that all of us do foolish things when we're driving. We try to multitask. We go too fast because we're in a hurry. We want to keep in touch with friends and family, so we talk on our cell phone or text. We eat. We take our eyes off the road. We fall asleep because we pushed ourselves. Our vehicle seems to become our little cocoon. We think that we can do everything that we want to do while we're driving, and we're forgetting that we're taking this 2,000-pound vehicle and driving it down the road, and we're getting, as time goes on, more and more forgetting about the responsibilities we have. And in the case, it comes down, and people's lives are being affected by what we're doing. And so many people look at a non-alcohol-related crash as an accident. And why should we be punishing? Why should we be enhancing the penalty? Because this was just an accident. And, just because a driver happens to be sober doesn't mean that it's not an accident. We have accepted that if a person is drinking and they cause a crash, it's a felony, and they're punished for that. And it's enhanced to make, if it's a minor injury, it's one level. If it's a more serious, if it's a death, it's a felony level executed prison. So we have already made that decision in alcohol related. Now, to talk about what Senator Betzel was saying, I also wonder why many, many years ago when the statute was written that they didn't make a different level for reckless. I agree with you. I think there should have been a gross misdemeanor on reckless all along, and then it probably wouldn't have had these same problems, because then you would have had, it already. But we do have reckless and careless as the same level, even though they have different bases. And so, a prosecutor who wants to take a non-alcohol-related crash that doesn't meet the gross negligence area probably would have made it the reckless. But why do the reckless when it's a very hard to prove area, and when the careless isn't as much? But I believe that when somebody kills somebody, that something should be more. Our organization assists many of the grieving families through the court system. When they are told that the only charge that can be given the person who killed their loved one is a misdemeanor, they are in shock. One family says, "How can you compare my son's life to a careless driving ticket?" Another said, "My nephew received a careless driving charge for going over the white line on a curve, and the person who killed my son only gets a misdemeanor." I mean, it's so difficult for the families to understand, and I don't think anybody realizes that until it happens to them. My daughter was killed 25 years ago by a drunk driver. But 25 years ago, it wouldn't have been much of a penalty, but because the person who killed her also died, I never had to go to trial, and I never had to be saying, "Well, it's not really that serious. It's only it was only an accident." And I think we have to look at that. And we've also heard from prosecutors who have said, the way the law reads right now, our hands are tied. You and I know that when a person is killed, it calls for more than a misdemeanor, but the law has limited us. Another prosecutor said, "This is one of the hardest things I have to do, and that is to tell parents that the person who killed their child will only be charged with a misdemeanor," which is the lowest criminal charge we have. And the person is dead, and they're not dead by something that was an accident. It was something that somebody intentionally did or was, You may not think that some of that was intentional, but, you know, whenever you're doing anything more than driving your vehicle and spending your time driving it, you are doing something that is not supposed to be done. Our law, like you said, our laws are enhanced based on the degree of harm to people or the value of property taken. There needs to be similar enhancements for non-alcohol-related traffic crashes as there is for alcohol-related traffic crashes. The prosecution needs to have an option of charging and convicting a person if the crash meets the seriousness of a gross misdemeanor. The law does allow for a felony, as I said, but the proof of gross negligence is extremely high and is rarely ever done, except in very high priority crashes. And increasing the penalty to gross misdemeanor will send a message to the seriousness of the crash and bring some justice to the surviving families. Like I said before, you'll never know how important this is until it affects your family and how you're going to feel when they get that slap on the wrist for killing your kid, where they may have been speeding, talking on the phone, going through a traffic light, making that right turn or, you know, left turn against the light. They're all careless driving, and it does need to be enhanced in some way.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Ms. Johnson, I can really sympathize with what you're saying and with what victims go through in these situations, and I might be more likely to support you if you were taking a reckless standard and wanting to enhance that to the gross misdemeanor level. But I'm really concerned kind of putting the two pieces together of what you said, that, you know, from time to time we are all do something careless. Careless is a very low standard, and it could be things arguably even a lot lower than the kinds of things you described, which are more deliberate. And saying that if that lack of attention that the person had, that they should have focus or whatever might have caused them to fit that definition, happened to result in a death because someone is in the wrong place at the wrong time, that we're going to put put the person in jail for a year, because that's, to me, that requires a higher level of culpability. And I agree that people should be held responsible civilly when this kind of thing happens, and they're not, you know, that's why we have insurance, because there are times when we're all not driving the way we should. But to say we could all go to jail for up to a year for those kinds of omissions, just to me, it's too big a step.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Ms. Johnson.
But we still have, it's not like an executed prison sentence. The judge can sentence anything up to that year in jail. The prosecutor can plead that down to the careless without the gross. So it does give a certain amount of options. And I do understand, because I've gone through this a lot myself on the reckless, but I was never able to figure out a terminology that would work. Willful and wanton is just about as bad as gross negligence. I do understand what you're saying on that, but I also, as a victims organization, is that we need to put some justice for the people, and we have enhanced things on other things that, you know, that were not, you know, you might have had a low level and something happens and it becomes high level because someone's dead. We're just looking for some justice and really feel that there should be some kind of enhancement when a death, especially a death, happens.
Senator Carlson, you've heard some of the concerns from the members. What would you like us to do? Would you like us to take a vote on this bill, or do you want to lay it on the table and think about it?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, may I just add, I found the letter from the Office of the City Attorney of Minneapolis helpful to me in a way. Part helpful and confusing maybe at the same time, because it talks about careless and reckless driving. It as maybe not the same, but at least in the same sentence, careless and reckless. And at the very end, it said, of the letter on the back side, it says that the City of Minneapolis agenda supports this, which enhances the penalty when careless driving results in death, and further supports a gross misdemeanor penalty when careless or reckless driving causes great bodily harm. Well, that, I'm just wondering, this bill doesn't do those things. And I think you need to address them both. I'm not sure, but I think that's what Senator Betzold was suggesting. Exactly. I think we do need to do that.
Senator Lemire?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Carlson, as I looked over your bill really is trying to address what I think is the proportionality of sentence when an event like this occurs and when a death is resulting. But I think some of our members are having a little difficulty trying to take a single change in the law and then try to correct the proportionality when we don't correct everything else. And so it's difficult. It's kind of, for lack of a better word, maybe a piecemeal solution to where you may want to go, but the rest of the law that surrounds it and the proportional sentencing standards around it no longer fit. And so I think that's where the difficulty is coming in. And I'm thinking that maybe with a little bit more work, a little more expansive work, we might be able to come to terms on it, but it's not as easy as what your bill might suggest. And I can sense the frustration on the part of the public of where is the justice in the event of an ultimate loss. And I'm not sure if this bill, it may satisfy that, but then it leaves the rest of our area of law that needs immediate attention, and I'm not sure if we have the time to do all of that. So I'm also wondering what you may want us to do.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I was also looking at Ms. Siegel's letter from the city attorney in Minneapolis, and she, in the sentence that Senator Scheid read, referenced a different bill. And I'm wondering if we are going to be hearing that other bill, Senate File 2503, and how that bill might be different from this one.
I believe those bills will return to the authors at the author's request. They're no longer in the committee, and we won't be scheduling those.
Madam Chair, that explains why then the
right.
They are addressing something more fully than this bill does. Now, I'm
Senator Carlson. What would you like? We certainly could take a vote.
I think
on
perhaps
it, so.
we could table it and get some more, do some more work on it.
All right. Thank you, Senator Carlson. Senator Senjum. Senator Senjum, welcome to the committee. Senate File 2555.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to recall, I think I've been here 7 years, and I've never been before your committee before. So please be nice.
You could have faked it. Now Senator Limmer is going to haze you.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, that is almost a daily occurrence, so I'm used to that. Madam Chair, Senate File 2555 deals with liability protection for volunteers. But before we get into that, I have an A2 delete all amendment to bring the bill into hopeful order that we've all agreed upon and which hopefully can maybe move forward good. Today. So if I can get some help in moving
Chair.
That would be appreciated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pearsall.
If 2555A1 is your amendment, Senator Senjum?
A2. Senator Pearsall.
It's been replaced by the A2 amendment. Senator Pearsall, would you like to move that?
I will move it.
A2 is coming.
Senator Pearsall moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. We'll be working off the A2 amendment. Senator Senjum.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, as I mentioned earlier, this is a bill that has to do with liability protection for volunteers in the course of activity related to an emergency event. It was frankly brought to me through the auspices of a volunteer who worked for the Red Cross, or with the Red Cross. And in that light, I think I'm going to just, Madam Chair, just turn this over to Dr. Rick Knowlton, who's a dentist and Byron, Minnesota, in my district, and he can talk through this from the standpoint of the whys and the wherefores.
Dr. Knowlton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill. Very simply, this is an initiative to allow entities, nonprofits, and business to have liability protection when helping out in a declared disaster, much like the volunteers who would be in a disaster such as the Medical Reserve Corps and Minnesota Response. But this is limited even further in that there's no workers' compensation. There's no compensation to the entity itself. It just offers just liability protection for their workers when working under the auspices of our government.
Good. Any questions for Senator Betzel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is more for counsel, too. This would differ from the Good Samaritan type law because they have to register with the jurisdiction ahead of time. Is that how this would work?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that's correct. As far as the liability standard, it's the same as the Good Samaritan law.
Okay. And Ms. Chair and Ms. Pontius, page 1, line 13 said a person who registers with that jurisdiction. This might sound a little absurd, but is it possible that somebody after the fact might circle back and then register after the event as opposed to making sure that you had already previously registered before that you had been involved in some good faith effort to help somebody? And so it just says registers. So what if somebody winds up helping and then they something goes wrong and they say, oh, I better register. Does that cover you even if you registered after the fact? It just said somebody who registers. I would think the word, I think previously registered might clarify that.
The intent here is to, Ms. Knowlton, to cover people who previously register with the municipality before they become a part of that group. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Senator Betzel, do you want to move that additional language?
If counsel has a different, but I would say is previously, who previously registers. So on page 1, line 13, after the word who, insert the word previously, and that, I think, would do it.
And also on line 19, Senator Betzel?
Yes.
Senator Betzel moves that language to amend the bill. Senator Sendrum, any objections? Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, absolutely not.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Just to make sure that that clarifies, though, the only concern I would have is that that isn't interpreted as meaning before the emergency or disaster. They would already have had to be registered. You mean before the event that could lead to liability, right, Senator Betzold? And
yeah, Madam Chair, that's my concern is that they don't become involved in an event that leads to liability and then register is to get the protection of the statute. I think that if we have requiring these people to register, which is what differentiates it from the Good Samaritan law, you have to be registered first before you can invoke the statute for any liability that may happen after you register.
That's correct. That's correct.
That's how I see it.
All right. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When it comes to the part on registration, is there a certain way how one would be registered? Is it a written, verbal? How would that work?
Madam Chair, Dr. Senator Limmer. Yes, there would have to be a written agreement. They would have to be with the government through the regular incident command system, and thus then the workers would be under the incident command system and under the guidance and command of the incident commander.
And Madam Chair, could that be done instantaneous upon the emergency, or do we want volunteers lining up and looking for something to sign first before they react?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that would be preferable to be pre-registered so that we would be ready to go. For example, we had a mass vaccination clinic in Olmsted County down at the college, and the American Red Cross provided volunteers, and the American Red Cross, that is the one time when they are as an entity covered by liability protection is under a mass vaccination clinic at the point of distribution. And they were all pre-registered. They were they underwent training and education and had to provide certificates of that education to the Red Cross and thus to the incident commander before they were allowed to act in the mass dispensing exercise.
You know, members, the language, I just want to draw your attention, line 1.5, where we defined entity. And then the actual language of the bill refers to individuals who are affiliated or associated with the entity that we define in law. So I think that that helps to tighten the language a little bit, as opposed to people who just sort of show up en masse. In order to benefit, to gain the benefit of this section, they would have to be affiliated, associated with, you know, the defined entity in a way that I think defines or tightens the language somewhat. So, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at line 1.23 and 2.4, and this is really more a question for counsel. Maybe this is language that mirrors what's in the Good Samaritan statute. I'm not sure. But logically to me in reading this, and I don't have to see Senator Higgins here, but it just doesn't make sense to me, because I think what we mean is a willfully negligent or wantonly negligent, you know, kind of the negligent standard. But what it says is does not apply if the agents act in a willful, take out the other parts, so they act in a willful manner in providing care. Well, everything you do is kind of willful. I mean, so to me, I think you mean willfully negligent or some kind of a, there seems to be a word missing there. To really direct what we're talking about in terms of the standard. And again, I'm not sure if this is already the language that's in the Good Samaritan statute, but it just seems like there's something missing there to me.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, yeah, this does mirror the Good Samaritan statute, and there's a whole body of case law as to what it means, even though I know it looks strange. It does require that it be both willful and either wanton or reckless, which is basically kind of a gross negligence. What you might think of as gross negligence. It's not simple negligence.
So, any further discussions on Senate File 2555 as amended? Senator Pearsall moves that Senate File 2555 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Senjum.
Thank you very much.
Senator Russ? Senator Russ, can we take 2267 first, the definition?
Yes. That would be my preference, Madam Chair.
Number are we on? We're going to take Senate File 2267 first. Senator Russ.
267. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2267 is a technical correction and clarification of the definition of firefighters. Last year, we passed a bill that established mandatory licensing for full-time professional firefighters beginning July 1 of 2011, and then included permissive licensing for volunteer firefighters. In the bill last year, we defined full-time firefighter as one employed and charged with either prevention or suppression of fires on a full-time basis. After the bill passed, some people were arguing that a person could be considered a firefighter, if they simply prevented fires and were employed by a fire department. That was not the intention of the legislation, and we were not intending that non-sworn personnel that did things like building inspections would be considered firefighters for the purposes of licensing. That was not the intent. And so the language in the definition now of full-time firefighter includes prevention and suppression, and then adds that it is a person who is either directly engaged in the hazards of firefighting or is in charge of a designated fire department.
Any questions for Senator Rest? Senator Betzel?
Just to be clear, Senator Rest, we're just amending a definition, but we don't have the whole chapter in front of us, or at least the section of law. What were some of the benefits or some of the things that people were trying to claim that they were firefighters when all they did were building inspectors? I mean, what kind of things were happening that caused us to take
there was
the definition?
A concern that if a building inspector could get the professional firefighter license, that would be a totally different kind of activity that would be qualifying for a license, but that it would also would be a concern with regard to whether those personnel would be eligible to join the pension funds.
Okay, thank you.
And any that was not intended by last year, right. Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, by last year's bill.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Senator Rest? Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2267 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Rest, Senate File 2413.
Madam Chair and members, you have the, I believe it is by now, the second engrossment of Senate File 2413, which started out in the State and Local Government Committee and then was reviewed by the Commerce Committee. What the bill does is to give cities discretionary authority. They don't have to do it, but they are permitted to do it, to permit full-time permanent firefighters and off-duty volunteer firefighters to solicit charitable contributions from motorists. This is the so-called, and I'm sure many of you have seen these folks, this is the so-called Fill the Boot project of the professional firefighters across the state of Minnesota, but most notably in the Twin Cities. The solicitation can be for only one charitable organization. It is the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and that organization and that's who will be testifying here today. That organization has to be a 501c3. The limitations are that the solicitation does not occur for more than 3 days, whether or not it is they are consecutive, and that the charitable organization provides to the municipality proof of commercial general liability insurance, and that is language that was cleaned up in advice of the representatives of the Insurance Federation in the Commerce Committee. Firefighters have indeed teamed up not just in Minnesota but all over the country with the Muscular Dystrophy Association to raise money to fund research pursuing treatments and cures for this muscle wasting disease. And over the 5 years, the MDA has contributed over $7.2 million in Minnesota to provide research, services, and information both to children and adults with muscular dystrophy. Under Fill the Boot, which is what the program is called, firefighters set up collection points at intersections and ask drivers to donate money by placing it in an empty firefighter boot. The firefighter organizations in Minnesota have been participating in Fill the Boot for several years, and in 2006, $36,000 was raised. The program is expanding every year, and last year, firefighters in 20 Minnesota cities raised about $300,000 for the cause. The reason why the bill is here, because the program has been in place for, as I mentioned, several years, but the city attorneys in Duluth and Minneapolis raised questions as to whether or not they actually had the authority to participate in this program, and it was decided that that was, if not in doubt, certainly something that should be cleared up. And so we have the legislation that is permissive for cities to allow full-time permanent firefighters to solicit charitable contributions in the Fill the Boot campaign while they are on duty. And the bill is modeled after similar legislation that has been enacted in California, Texas, and Florida, which are also heavily involved in this effort. Again, the bill, the language is permissive. It authorizes, it does not require the cities to allow firefighters to collect money for a charity while on duty. I have Mr. Thornburg from the, who is president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters here to speak to the bill, and representatives from MDA and the benefits from the work that the research that and outreach that the MDA does in the state of Minnesota through the good work of Minnesota's professional firefighters.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Thornburg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And as Senator Rest stated, we have been doing this Fill the Boot on duty, on the street, for a few years now. It's been very successful. The contributions keep going up every year, and we add more cities that are allowing the firefighters to do it every year. Firefighters across the United States and Canada have been doing this for more than 55 years, and firefighters are the single largest contributor to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. This is a longstanding relationship with the MDA, and we're proud to be part of it. As Senator Rest said, we had some questions come up with, in particularly in Duluth and Minneapolis, on regards of whether we could continue to do this without statute or an attorney general's ruling, and that's the reason that we've brought this bill before you.
Thank you. Is it Ms. Abramson? Abrahamson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Abrahamson. I'm with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and I just am here today to briefly provide you with some information about MDA and as Mr. Thornburg alluded to, the partnership that we have with the professional firefighters. MDA, one of the most important things about us is that the money that we raise is just like what Senator Rest says, is stays local. And in the last 5 years, we have donated or put in $7.2 million into the state. Some of the money that we generate goes into various research programs as well as services we offer. We have over 2,000 families here in the state of Minnesota that we serve locally. We have three offices that cover those families' needs in Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. And some of the services and things that we provide includes research. In the last 18 months, and we've put in $1.7 million of research into Rochester Mayo, as well as the University of Minnesota, as well as the U of M was also chosen as an elite researcher on Duchenne muscular dystrophy. They're one of 10 in the entire country that gets an additional $1 million a year towards their efforts in that research. We also have clinics throughout the state that our patients can go to, and we act as a contributor there to make sure that their medical needs are met. We have clinics in Duluth, here in Gillette and St. Paul, as well as the U of M in Minneapolis. We also fund things like a week-long summer camp program that Lynn's son participates in and gets to be a part of and meet friends that are going through some similar life circumstances as him, and we pay the tuition essentially for those kids to go to this camp free of charge. In total, over the last year, we spent about $400,000 on programs like summer camp and our clinics, paying for things like flu shots and things like that. So in total, $7.2 million over the last 5 years. In fact, in 2009, we funded about $2.54 million into the state, but actually only generated about $1.9 million. So MDA does actually, as an national organization, has put in another $600,000 into the state for those services. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Abrahamson, are your organization is all right with the purchase of the liability insurance?
Madam Chair, yes, we are. We do carry insurance that would additionally insure the municipalities as well as cover insurance for the firefighters while participating in Fill the Boot.
And then, Mr. Thornburg, can you give us a little bit of perspective on why the firefighters have to be on duty?
Madam Chair, yes. We, for several years prior to doing on-duty Fill the Boot, we tried doing other programs. We've been down the Nicollet Mall, Minneapolis. We've done fairs. We've surrounded the Metrodome. And we could not raise nearly the numbers that we have with doing on-duty Fill the Boot. As I stated previously, this has been going on across the country for many, many years, going back over 55 years. And it's been proven that the on-duty Fill the Boot raises the largest amount of money. So we started doing it here in Minnesota, and we've proven that, and our numbers show that. And 5 years ago, firefighters had raised a total of around $35,000, and now with the starting of Fill the Boot, we're up to nearly $300,000. I can tell you, I work for Minneapolis Fire Department. 3 years ago, we started it, and our first year was $36,000. The second year, we were up to $68,000, and last year, we raised over $90,000. So the on-duty Fill the Boot is certainly the best way for us to do it. And because of our 24-hour shifts, we do have, some downtime. Sometimes we're just at the fire station. We're waiting for a call. When we're doing Fill the Boot, we're still waiting for a call, which is that we're outside. Actually, our response times have improved when we've been out doing Fill the Boot because we're already out on the street. We're dressed in our gear, and our truck is just a few feet away from us, and we're ready to go.
Very good. Any questions? Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, are you going to hear from my other witness, too?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I only had two witnesses on the list. I thought she was just to answer questions,
sorry.
But you're welcome to. Let's have Senator Limmer ask this question, then we'll put you to the mic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, as I look at your bill, and the question comes up on general liability insurance issue, if there was an event that triggered a liability, Would the municipality be in first place as the target of that potential lawsuit, or would it be the insurance company that's listed here?
Ms. Abrahamson?
Madam Chair, Senator, actually the way that our insurance works as far as if an incident happened is we step in as the initial and primary insurance.
All right. And then in the event that there's a cap to some insurance liability by the policy, if it exceeds that, then is the municipality going to be the target for the overage of that dollar amount?
It would be a possibility.
Ms. Abrahamson?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, it's a possibility.
And is there, Madam Chair, is there...
Senator Limmer.
Is there a discussion of where the cap would be or what would be the appropriate coverage for the insurance? Is there...
Madam Chair,
Senator,
how do they figure that out?
To keep in mind that this is not a requirement. If a city is risk averse to allowing, this kind of activity going on, they simply won't allow it. So they, I think, the cities will understand that there is this $1.5 million policy in place that would be covered by MDA, and if they feel that. They would have some risk on that. They would just simply say no. It's permissive.
Senator Rest, your other witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Tibbetts. I'm one of the families that the MDA and the support of the firefighters helps in my battle daily, as my son, at his 3-year-old checkup, was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. My son Jason is now 15. He is becoming weaker every day and more dependent instead of becoming more independent, as all his classmates are becoming. As a teenager, it's humiliating, it's devastating, And as a parent, it's my worst nightmare. I can't make my son better. The money that the firefighters raise stays local. I see it benefit my family and many's every time that MDA supports me in some way or another. This year, I'm proud to say Jason is the MDA Goodwill Ambassador for the state of Minnesota. 5 years ago, I would have never thought that was possible. 5 years ago is when Jason stopped walking. When I found out at three, he was a walking, talking, rambunctious three-year-old. He could do more at age three than he can do today. But through camp, through the clinics, through the support we receive through Gillette, that MDA funds with the money that the firefighters raise, Jason has found a new sense of self. He found a new confidence, and now he's speaking and teaching others, especially at his high school, just exactly what he's capable of doing. I have no doubt that he will be a great contributor to our society. I have been out there with the firefighters that have done Fill the Boot, and I hear, as a taxpayer, the concerns of the committee and the insurance issues. But I have seen our firefighters, and who better to teach safety and to fill the boot in this situation. It's inspiring to those who hear, who the firefighters are helping, my family one of them. I see it inspire those who are donating. There's nothing better than to see a little kid drop a quarter or a dollar to a full uniform firefighter. It's touching. It touches them, and I think it's inspiring to those firefighters. They're willingly taking their downtime and going out and filling their boot to better their community. And as a family who benefits, I couldn't be more grateful. It's what gets me up every day. The cure is coming close. I see the research doing great things. I follow it very closely. It's what gets me out of bed every day so I can fight the fight. And I know that with the help of the firefighters, it'll come just that much sooner. And I just hope that you guys can find a way through these concerns to let this great tradition and how they serve our community even more so continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to the committee. Ms. Abrahamson, do you purchase these types of liability insurance for other states or in other municipalities where you guys have your program?
Madam Chair, the policy that we have is actually for the MDA has purchased as a whole as a nationwide organization for firefighters across the country. They are the only national sponsor and supporter that we do purchase an insurance policy for.
And what's the limit on that?
It's a $1.5 million.
It's $1.5 for everyone. Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Foley?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm concerned about this because it comes from another source, the danger that the people that are collecting the money pose. It seems to me that that we should be looking at something that's perhaps more safe than what occurs. If this isn't just the fire folks, it's also a American Legion and the VFW, their Poppy Days. They stand in the street and collect these dollars. But be that as it may, and I know you can tell me some heart-rendering stories about families of people that have benefited from the thing, and I'm not disputing that, but I do know that when I used to be on the State Patrol, we used to get complaints on folks that were doing that, and so I'm wondering if this is not a good a deal as what we think so far as the use of these folks. It might be different in the city of Minneapolis or the city of St. Paul, but it's clearly not the same in other communities that are much smaller and are not going to have the uniformed firefighter or the regular firefighter. So just throw that out for your observation, I guess.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
Once again, I think the crux of it is not just the program. It is that the city has total authority about whether to permit it to happen. And if they think that there are traffic hazards that would be caused by it, then they will not allow the firefighters, if they professional or the voluntary ones, to do it. They have to act in favor of doing it. The firefighters cannot just do it on their own accord. And it raises a question, quite frankly, about whether I don't know whether the American Legion or the Poppy Fellers or whatever, if they're standing on the street corners, whether they have had to have gotten a license to do that, or if there's an ordinance in the city. But we did know that the city attorneys from Duluth and Minneapolis thought that they either needed an attorney general's opinion, that they had the authority. It was mostly to allow these folks to do this while they were on downtime but on duty. That was the concern of the cities with regard to the liability. And I don't know where the other nonprofit organizations that are out there that do soliciting, where they get their authority to do that. I simply don't know.
Any further discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Parasol.
I've done it for the Legion and the VFW often. They don't get permits, you know, but we just get our assignments. You stand by the air control center or a plant, you know, or any facility that's got a lot of employees and shake the can.
Right. Well, and I think
so. We don't have little permits for each.
Senator Parasol, and they usually are not. As you just said, they're in front of a store, they're in front of a plant, and they're not firefighters. You're not a firefighter.
That's right.
And I would think they're volunteers.
Or an employee of they're all volunteers of the city.
Right. They're volunteers who are not doing this as on duty. So, any further discussion? Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see why this bill is before us. I understand exactly what you're trying to do. I certainly commend the MDA and the firefighters for what they do, but this has much broader application when it can be for any charitable organization and not just for the MDA. And I wonder if the firefighters, then why not the police or why not other government employees? I'm not sure you've struck the proper balance there, Senator Rust. I mean, I understand you're trying to do permissive or grant permissive authorities to cities to do this, but I think there's a preference for the firefighters. There's not a preference for MDA. I understand you're trying to value the tradition, but it's not really tracking the tradition here. So I'm not really all that comfortable with the balance of what you've done here, whether it's broad or specific.
Well, Madam Chair and
Senator Rust.
You know, the city attorney said that we needed the language for the firefighters because they were on duty, off downtime. I think the statutes generally frown on naming specific entities, and so that's why the organization is defined as a 501c3 in the Internal Revenue Code. And if the quite frankly, if the police officers or any other entity, group of employees wanted to establish this kind of tradition, they would have the authority to go and ask for statutory authority for X group of employees to do this. This is specific to the firefighters. It is their tradition. And again, it is permissive. A city does not have to do this for any group of employees, and we're just clarifying that they can do it and that the firefighters are protected by a liability policy. It's across the country, and it's a well-established relationship. So I think the balance is there.
Any further questions? Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2413 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Second engrossment, right.
Yeah. What did you say?
The second engrossment.
The second engrossment, right. Yes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And members.
Senator Sachs-Hogg, Senate File 345. Senator Sachs-Hogg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 345. Under Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, travel documents have been necessary for U.S. citizens to cross the Canadian and Mexican borders since the year 2009. This bill will allow legal Minnesota residents to apply for an enhanced driver's license that will qualify for travel under the WHTI. I need one amendment moved to move the effective dates for sections 1 through 11 out 3 years and to insert the EDL license language in section 171.12 to line up with regular driver's licenses. If a committee member could make that motion.
I'm sure I'll move that.
Let's see. Does everyone have the A2 amendment? Although this is not the first committee, I believe that this is just technical to make sure the bill was referred to us last year, and we want to make sure that the effective dates are lined up correctly. So Senator Higgins has moved the A2 amendment. Any discussions on the A2 amendment?
We don't have it. Oh, here it is.
Going on faith, you know. Now I'll move it.
Any discussions on the A2 amendment? See none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stumpf, Senator Bach, and I are the three senators that represent the entire border of our northern neighbor, Canada. I'm unique in that group of the three because I'm the only one who actually has to take an international trip to get to the part of the district that I represent, the northwest angle. Mm. To preserve travel, trade, and cultural ties with Manitoba and Ontario, and also to increase security at the border, we would like to offer enhanced driver's license, enhanced ID cards to Minnesota residents who voluntarily choose to participate. I'd like to bring up a couple things, and then Bob Anderson on my right, former mayor of International Falls, current public affairs manager of Boise Cascade, the largest employer in the Falls, and the actual owner of half the International Bridge at the Rainy River, is going to give some brief testimony. And then I have with me on my left Pat McCormick from the Department of Public Safety, and she'll briefly go over the bill and help answer any questions. There's some additional information in your packets that might be helpful at concerns comparing the enhanced driver's license to the real ID, the RFID chip and the EDL card. We have this little bit distorted map, but it indeed the red and the green are all the states and provinces that have passed the enhanced driver's license up to this point. I believe there may even be a sample of the cards, the actual ID cards from Washington, Michigan, New York, and Vermont are the states that have passed the EDL to this point, and provinces Quebec, British Columbia, Manitoba, and Ontario. So one of the advantages of this EDL card would be that it would be about $20 less than a passport card, and it should also be noted that this card cannot be used with air travel. It has to be on land or sea. So with that, unless you have any direct questions for me, I'm going to ask Mr. Anderson to take it from here.
Mr. Anderson, who won the tug of war last year?
Fort Francis.
And,
wow.
And And Senator Moy, we appreciate the fact that you were up in the falls. That was almost 2 years ago now, wasn't it?
It was. Three sessions ago. But it was a great trip.
Yeah.
Mr. Anderson, and you were a wonderful host. And Senator Scheid was there, and as was Senator Rest. And for the rest of the committee members, if you feel left out, we did invite you, but you all chose not to come along. So we had a very good visit. Ms. Anderson, welcome all the way to St. Paul, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And first, allow me to thank you and your colleagues for coming to International Falls. And I believe it was February of 2008 when you were there. And for your interest and concerns with the cross-border travel issue and the trade issues that we face as a community up there. The enhanced driver's license bill has the support of the City of International Falls and the Greater International Falls Chamber of Commerce. My employer, Boise Paper, is a partner in the ownership of the International Bridge, as Senator Saxhog pointed out. We have seen a significant decline in cross-border travel, with the requirement of the Nexus and passport cards coming into effect. Allow me to cite some figures for you. In 2008, cross-border travel for trade and recreation saw 900,000 persons cross the border at the International Falls Fort Francis port of entry. In 2009, with the need for a Nexus card or a passport card, the number of persons that crossed the border at that same port was 708,000, just about 200,000 less for that year, about a 22% decline. International Falls location is 100 miles from the next nearest city of comparable population, except for our sister city in Fort Francis, Ontario. The two communities share many family and cultural events together. Believe it or not, the city of Fort Francis and their business community offers the International Falls residents some retail advantages. For a number of years, Fort Francis had the only McDonald's restaurant in the two communities. So if you had a Big Mac attack, you had to go to Fort Francis to satisfy it. Today, Fort Francis has the only Walmart store in the two communities. Now, having shared that, there are many, many Canadian citizens from a great distance, 100 miles or more, that travel to International Falls to shop the Menards Home Building store that we have in our community. So cross-border travel is very, very important to the two communities. Tens of thousands of Minnesota residents cross into Canada every year to do business, to hunt, and to fish. Many hockey teams from our communities travel to the border and want to compete with the communities of Fort Francis, Kenora, Dryden, and Thunder Bay. This could likely be increased now that the Olympics is over, even though Canada did win the gold. All of this cross-border travel, I said, is truly an economic boon to our community. Most everyone in our society has to have a driver's license, and for a few dollars additional, that driver's license could also serve as a passport for cross-border travel, and it would put that back into reach for many of the citizens of our area. My thanks to you for the opportunity to share this information today.
Thank you. Ms. McCormick?
Before Ms. McCormick starts, Madam Chair, I was just going to mention, because we were talking about the Olympics, that both Washington and British Columbia have the enhanced driver's license, so it was put to very good use during the Olympics.
Yeah, you know, Senator Saxhog, the inspiration for our Northern Borders tour was a result of a border security visit to Vancouver through Washington State, through the NCSL.
Yep.
And they did say that a lot of the changes that they had put in place, including multiple lanes for going back and forth, and, you know, juxtaposed to the one or two lanes in Fort Francis, it was interesting that they did all of that in preparation for the Olympics. So I did put a call into my friend who is a state representative in Washington State to find out what the experience has been given the volume of people going back and forth. And it'd be interesting to hear from them at the next NCSL meeting.
Yeah.
how all that went.
Thank you for sharing that, ma'am.
Yeah. Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety. And I'll just kind of go through the bill just to outline some of the requirements that would be part of any enhanced driver's license from the requirements that we have looked at with the Department of Homeland Security. And so, first of all, it would be able to be used as a driver's license and have the technology features, which includes an RFID, a radio frequency chip in the card, so that it could be used. It would be a randomly selected number, but that number would be in the database that Homeland Security and the Border Patrol has, so that if as you're going through the border lane, you'd be able to hold it up and it would read that it was a valid number. There's no biometric or any biographical data that's contained in that chip. So it's just something to be able to be used to show that it is a valid number and it is one that's listed on the as an approved enhanced driver's license. And it also has to be approved by the Department of Homeland Security, and as later states in the bill, there would need to be an agreement that would be reached between the commissioner and the Department of Homeland Security so that we were able to agree to which requirements or what kinds of information would be needed in order to apply for enhanced driver's license. Ineligibility, that section relies on what people that now are considered ineligible for any kind of a driver's license or ID card, and that would include people that are revoked or suspended, have their license suspended, or they meet the 171.04, which says they're not entitled to a driver's license. Application forms, we would have to have specific forms for this that would be approved by our commissioner and also approved by the Department of Homeland Security. The fees, that it adds a $15 fee to the regular driver license or identification card cost, and that would be for all Class D drivers, all commercial drivers, ID cards, and it could also be for instruction permits. As you'll note that you can't be under 16 to get an enhanced driver's license or ID card. And that's because that's what the federal rules say, that anyone under that age does not need to have one in order to go by land or sea across the border. In addition, then, that requires an application and has to have proof of your legal name, a U.S. citizenship identity document, your date of birth, social security number, residence address, and a photographic identity document. And, Madam Chair, I understood that you were hoping I would have information from the Department of Homeland Security. I have requested it as to specifically what they require. I've had informal discussions with them, and when the state of Washington was here a couple years ago for a hearing, I did talk to the woman that administers the programs there, but we will get something that will outline it. In general, it would just be probably what we usually use in it would be the requirements that we already have in place right now, except it would only be requirements that would be used, which would also substantiate citizenship. So in other words, some of the temporary legal status documents for immigration you wouldn't be able to use, but it would involve certificate of naturalization, certificate of citizenship. So it would be these requirements, and I have brought copies for all the committee members if they'd like to look over those rules. So we do have that in place. And so it wouldn't be any, it wouldn't be much different from what we normally do on our driver's license, except for any temporary residents that were here, that you, because you have to be a citizen in order to get this card. Then in addition to that, we would allow for the security features that would protect the card. And as you know, I think one of our driver's license, we believe, is a very secure license. We will be going out for a new contract and probably will upgrade our security features as part of that in the next year and a half. I think that, as you all know, you kind of have to stay ahead of the curve in terms of keeping it more secure and different types of card materials, and so that's what we would do, and we would be as the senator mentioned, with the change in the effective date, it would, if this would pass, it would probably be included when we started a new contract and we upgraded our features in the current card that we have right now. Identity photographs, this would be required, so that right now we have an exception for religious purposes or for people that are not allowed to wear or cannot for medical reasons wear headwear. We would require a photograph on these licenses, which would be different from our other driver's license and ID cards, where we allow you not to have a photograph. You have to provide the department with a biometric that we keep on file for law enforcement for investigative purposes, public safety purposes. And then, as I said, we would probably have to amend the current rules that allow us to require these documents for driver's licenses and IDs. So we would, that offers that rulemaking authority. And then a different effective date if the bill was to pass. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Ms. McCormick? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McCormick, there's references to the approval by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Now, when the legislature considered Real ID the last 2 years in the legislature, Homeland Security was referenced there as well. But according to federal law, Congress gave the Homeland Security Department sweeping authority into the future to alter the requirements of Real ID, which could have involved a number of other data that would be collected in a Real ID-inspired driver's license. The reference in this bill is slightly different, and it makes reference to being this card would be approved by the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. If their requirements change, is this kind of like a sliding requirement that if they change their requirements, Minnesota has to change their requirements as well and follow the federal direction of this card? Or is it specific to the date now?
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, this card is voluntary, and it would not... My reading and my discussions that I've had and briefings on this card, there are federal regulations that are, you know, that were promulgated for this card, but it basically relies on an agreement between the state and with the Department of Homeland Security. And in that sense, it's very different than Real ID, where that was part of a federal act that required every state to submit to those guidelines. And in there, you were talking about verification of data, which is much different than we're talking about with this particular card. The data stays within our state driver's license information system. The data is not shared with the Department of Homeland Security. which I know was a concern to some in terms of real ID. And so it's very different in that sense than the Real ID Act would be.
Now, Madam Chair,
Senator Lemmer,
the way this bill is written, we, the legislature, are giving the authority to, well, maybe negotiate is not the word that I'm looking for, but to administrate the relationship between the requirements of Homeland Security and the state with the commissioner. The legislature is somewhat distant from that relationship or from those terms. And so by us allowing the commissioner to handle the administration, is he subject then to the Department of Homeland Security, or is he subject to the Minnesota legislature?
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, because of the fact that there would be rulemaking required, which would allow us, the legislature would have to allow the approval of those rules that would outline what documents or what documents could be used to apply for an enhanced driver's license. I would believe that it would still be under the review and oversight of the legislature and state government. I don't believe that it would be, because those are our rules. Those aren't federal rules. All the federal rules are pretty broad in terms. They just say we have to have specific requirements and citizenship. They're very broad. They're not specific to the types of verification that I think was the concern, where we were having to have everything verified. You're not verifying that information at the border, so it's quite a bit different than the Real ID Act.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
You had made reference to the requirements of Homeland Security for the purposes of this card. Do you have those available to us to review at this time before we make our decision?
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, I'm not sure if I brought a copy with me. I have one back in my file, but it is online. They aren't, I'm not sure I have it with me right at this minute.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer?
Just to recall, this is not Real ID, I know that. The legislature, though, 200 of the 201 legislators voted to prohibit Minnesota from being involved in the Real ID program last year. A fairly overwhelming statement not to get involved in that program. But I'm a little hesitant to give support on this since I don't have the requirements of Homeland Security. And Homeland Security, whether it was under the Bush administration or under the Obama administration, has some rather sweeping authority that's been given to it that can make policy directions on its own. And then if it does, then the commissioner in this regard would be subject to that relationship. And the way this is written, if I understand it right, he can make that decision on his own without legislative approval. And so I'm a little hesitant to give support to this because I don't know what those federal requirements are for the card.
Ms. McCormick, in the rules that have been promulgated by the feds with respect to this program, where is the space? We talk about the feds having rules that have been promulgated, and then we have this agreement that gets negotiated between the state of Minnesota and the feds, and then we have the commissioner doing rulemaking. So at what point do we as legislative bodies get to see if we're looking for a reference of what the world would be if we become an EDL state, will we look at the rules that are promulgated by the feds, or will we look at the agreement that was negotiated, or should we look at the rules that's promulgated by the commissioner?
Well, Madam Chair, usually we wouldn't be sharing. It wouldn't be unusual for us to come and brief committees on what we've negotiated in terms of any type of agreement, and obviously those are all public documents. We wouldn't be negotiating an agreement that wasn't public, so that that would be available for you to see. I think the key is the agreement with between Homeland Security and the state. But in talking to the states that I know of, and I know Michigan probably the best because the administrator is in the same region that I'm in, and we have regional meetings. And in talking to him, it was very much the state that was in the driver's seat, so to speak, with no pun intended, but in terms of trying to ensure that it met what their standards were in our driver's license. And I can tell you that would be the only way I think it would be, you know, it would work in our state as well. But certainly that type of an agreement, we certainly would be able to brief the committee or the legislature on as part of that. Obviously, you also, anything that we're agreeing to in any rulemaking, there's places all along the way that you would have the ability that you would know what we were doing in terms of promulgating our rules, and those also have to go before the governor has to sign those rules and so make sure they move forward. So, and that's a very open process. So.
And just so that I'm clear on this, the rulemaking, the commissioner's rulemaking, even though we authorize in this legislation, the rulemaking would be only after the agreement has been negotiated with the feds. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, I would think it would be after that. But I would say that I think the department would want to stay as close to what we currently are requiring in terms of our driver's license and identification. So I wouldn't see it as being any different, because I think most states feel pretty strongly about retaining their ability to ensure public safety within their state and ensuring we would be doing the same types of requiring the same kinds of documentation and the same way we do business with all of our other driver's license holders.
So, Ms. McCormick, then with respect to the headgear question then, because in Minnesota, I think through rules, we do allow individuals, particularly from communities where headdress is part of what they wear. I believe it was through rules that we do allow that, even though there's not an explicit exception in the statutes. And I see here, though, in the bill that there is a provision that says that those exceptions that we provide under Minnesota for Minnesota's driver's licenses will not be permitted for an enhanced driver's license. How does that work if our goal here is to try to maintain as much of what we have under Minnesota law as possible?
Madam Chair, I don't know for sure, and that would be a question I'd need to ask about the headwear part of it. I think that the part that they require is that it has to have a full-faced image, which is what our rules say. We still allow headwear as long as you can see the whole face, but we allowed you to wear headwear, and then if for religious purposes you wear headwear, we would certainly want to retain that, because that was something that we worked out with various communities when we developed our rules in 2002, if I'm not mistaken. But I'd have to go back and check, because that might be something that we would want to look at in terms of verifying with Homeland Security if that's what they mean. Because my understanding is it has to have a photo. From my understanding of the rules and the regulations, it talks specifically about the fact that you have to have a photo on the card. And I'm not sure it said anything about headwear. We allow that exception, as I said, for people that don't want their photo for some kind of a religious or belief reason on their card.
Senator Saxhawk, Section 11 of the bill at line 1.76 talks about that, and it does here contradict what in the way that Ms. McCormick didn't represent what is true about Minnesota law, but this does say that our practice in allowing headwear would not be permitted, or individuals who want to wear headgear for their enhanced driver's license would not be permitted to get one. So I think that if it is not the intention for us to prohibit people and to align our criteria for the enhanced driver's license as much to what we have under current Minnesota law as possible, or even in rules, we should take a look at that section. Senator Pearsall?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McCormick, I'm looking at Section 6 on the piece that outlines, it's number 345 with the creating enhanced driver's license, but it's on page 2, number 6, application requirements. And I look at it, and it requires an application for an enhanced driver's license or ID card to include proof of the applicant's full legal name. First of all, I have a problem with that because the last time I got my driver's license renewed, for some reason, they changed the name. I mean, I don't have a middle name. I've never been given a middle name. And so I had my first given name is Patricia, and then my married last name is Pearsall. But they inserted in there Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, which was my maiden name, and they're using it as my middle name, which it is not. And it never has been. And that, if we'd have to have one that shows your entire name, I'd be out of sport right there. And then the proof of citizenship, I don't have a birth certificate of my own. I could get one from St. Paul. I'm sure they'd have it that goes back that far. I'm an old bag. But anyway, I'm sure they have it. But I probably have to pay triple for it for the date it would be. But I have to get that, and I wouldn't mind getting that. But then some of these other things in the Social Security card, I've got two or three of those sitting around with the right number on them. And a photographic, I have that, but that, full legal name and United States citizenship, I mean, my birth would show that, birth certificate would show that, but I don't have one today.
Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess the only thing I would say.
And I'm not alone, I'm sure.
Sorry. This, I think, is to make it easier compared to the requirements we have now, which you'd probably have to have more, even, you know, if you were going to get a passport.
No, I've had several of those.
Oh, you haven't had to worry about that?
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, my question then was kind of a data practices one. When we dealt with Real ID, one of the concerns and objections, and I know there were many concerns and objections, but one of them had to do with if we shared the driver's license or the ID information with other states, then it really was only secure as the weakest link in the chain, and we have quite stringent data practices, security things in place in Minnesota, and we didn't want to put that information out there where some other states have perhaps less secure practices. Is there anything in this bill that would allow rulemaking that would allow that kind of sharing either with the feds or with the state government, or would that still be precluded? And so would there be no expansion of that, or is there a possibility of expanding into that area under this?
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, no, there wouldn't be anything in this bill that would allow for us to share information with we share information with other states if we have a pointer system that's used, because if you move from one state to the next, that we need to make sure that the state can check on the status of the driver's license from the state they moved from. But what it does is it just points you to the data from that particular state. So you're not transmitting data at all. The person has to get that data from the state that they need the data from. And so there would be nothing in this that would change that, and nothing in our current data practices laws that would be changed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On that point, in the case that we're using a pointer system to share data, at least the state of Minnesota with the appropriate commissioners are, it's presumed that they follow our law. We're administrating the direct sharing of that. The real ID issue was that the federal, or the decision to join with the federal government to be a part of real ID, it wasn't necessary for the state of Minnesota to administrate that sharing. Anyone could pull up on a data system in a complementary state that was sharing the agreement, could pull up data, intimate, personal, private data on some computer in any other state in the country. And the only question that I would have is, since we don't have the federal guideline in front of us of what we're allowing the commissioner to be in agreement with, I don't know if we know that. Nor if the Department of Homeland Security changes its rules and wants to share, how would we know if we're giving the authority just to the commissioner to administrate what the feds want from us?
We could say
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
McCormick?
Senator Limmer, I think that the difference would be there would have to be a law that would be passed at the federal level. They couldn't expand. These are separate regulations. The WIDI regulations are separate. They have nothing to do with the Real ID regulations. They have nothing to do with the U.S. Patriot Act. And so it would have to be a different law that would be passed. And I think that in general, I mean, there was pushback on many states with having any kind of database that would be including everyone's information. I think in general, as you know, most states want to uphold the constitutional amendment that provides that kind of data is under the state's authority and not the federal authority. And so,
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer,
I have to caution myself as not to characterize this bill as a real ID bill. And Senator Saxhog and the mayor simply want a convenient way for them and their citizens that are along an international border to be able to come and go in the general course of commerce and travel that is kind of required between two cities that share a common border. It's kind of like how would we travel between Minneapolis and St. Paul in a convenient way. We have international law that now requires at least the provinces of Canada are now using or complying with a more stringent requirements on border crossings. And then this is just to facilitate the back and forth travel of businesses, citizens, families that like to share both communities. The only thing that I'm just cautioning is that Real ID brought us down a different path, and they were going to share a lot of data and collect a lot of data, and yet it was at kind of a blank check. It was the authority of the Homeland Security was given the authority to strengthen, tighten, expand without Congress ever visiting it again. And I guess I need to know whether or not Homeland Security has been given that same authority to change its requirements with the states that agree on this, whether it's a commissioner or not. And that's all. I don't have the full picture in front of me to determine what authority that Homeland Security has been given in order to this.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think that
the information that we were given about the radio frequency ID might give you a little comfort in the knowledge that this card isn't going to have all manner of information about you. If I understand it correctly, it has a unique number and then something that verifies that you are a citizen, and that's all. And Homeland Security can do whatever it wants, but if that's all that card has, then that information isn't accessible to Homeland Security, or other information isn't accessible through these cards. And Ms. McCormick is nodding, so I think I got that right, which impresses me that I got that right. But
Hannah's volunteer.
And the rest of us, too.
Thank you. But if we're done talking about that piece, I have a question on Section 12.
Please.
Okay. Section 12 is all one sentence, which is probably part of what I'm struggling trying to understand. But at the end of that sentence, there's this phrase about upon implementation of section something or another of some act that was passed in 2004. And I'd like to have a little more information about who's implementing and what that might be. And then if that is in fact the trigger for entering into an agreement, I would propose that we take that phrase and put it at the beginning of the sentence, because that's the beginning of the process. And then that maybe would help me with being able to understand the rest of the sentence.
Upon implementation.
Yes, starting with upon
Ms. McCormick.
Implementation.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, my recollection is that this was just one. This had to do with trying to secure the borders and talking about land and sea travel. And so this gave the Secretary of Homeland Security the authority to establish an enhanced license program for that reason. But I don't have that specific document with me right now. But that's my recollection of what it was. I'm not an expert on the federal law. I only know it in terms of how it impacts our state. But it is voluntary. It is not anything that's required of any state. This is a voluntary program, but I'm pretty sure the rest of the act talks about securing borders at sea and land borders. And so this was just one part of that that act that was passed.
And so, Madam Chair and Ms. McCormick, then has that been implemented? Can that whole section, or can that whole phrase go away then?
Madam Chair and
Ms. McCormick?
Senator Higgins, I'm not sure if it can or not. I could check more with my contact at Department of Homeland Security. I think that's just to put it, to show where it came, the authority came from, I'm assuming, but I'm not a drafting attorney. So.
And then, Madam Chair, I'll note that in Senate Counsel's summary, it says that it's upon implementation of the Federal Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative Law. So calls it something else than the Intelligence Reform Terrorism Prevention Act. So if we could get maybe a little more information about that piece, that might help us in trying to decipher what this actually means. Probably not for tonight, though.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, the fact is that these are voluntary. You know, this is something that a person can ask to have or not. And so I'm not too troubled about, I mean, I care what they know about me, but given the parameters that are in the bill, I'm fine with that. You know, I don't support the Real ID Act either, Senator Limmer, but I think, you know, the possibility that the federal government would just impose it is probably always there. And you know, I don't think that will affect our driver's license law nor our enhanced driver's license law until, I mean, I don't think they would be affected until they overrule it. And I, you know, do they have the authority to do that? Well, they may have. And so it may be some language in here that says we would revisit this or that this is, you know, subject to review by us every so often might help with that. I mean, I'm not suggesting, I certainly don't support their doing that, but I think they could at any time anyway. So if they want to. And so I suppose there's no protection, you know, at the end of the day for our having that information stored about us someplace. But I think we could do some comfort language. Well, not comfort, but some kind of protective language, and then remember that this is a voluntary thing and not required of anybody.
Ms. McCormick, I'm really I'm not expecting you to be able to answer these questions. I put a call in hoping that we could get a federal person here to answer some questions about federal documents. Because I think that the comparison here would be, are we necessarily requiring Minnesotans to do any more than what they would have to do if they were actually applying for a passport? Or are we just asking them to do the same thing? Or are we asking here for an opportunity for them to do less in terms of the enhanced driver's license? And I wonder if you could answer that question, because the intent here is not so much that, I mean, I guess the intent here is, and if I recall our visit to our northern border neighbors, is that there are too many documents for people to have to carry back and forth for the land travel. You have your driver's license, then you have to carry some other reentry identification like a passport or something else. And the desire here is that if there's a vehicle available, they like to be able to collapse the documents into one, which in essence becomes the enhanced driver's license. And so I wonder if you could tell us, or maybe Senator Saxhog, if the information that we're asking to be put on these enhanced driver's license is the same, or is it more than what the feds would require of somebody who is applying for a passport?
Madam Chair, and I would just say that I thought I might have a document that talked about that, but I guess I don't. I would say that it's pretty similar, except you're talking about the fact that it would be usually when you're going in for a passport, my experience is you have to bring in your certified birth certificate, which is what we often get for driver's licenses as well. And in addition to that, a driver's license is one thing, or some kind of photo identification to get a passport. That's what my experience is, but I haven't done it for a few years. So in our case, we have a, you know, for instance, in our state, we have a variance process. And so we may have, in the case like Senator Pariseau is talking about, if she didn't have a birth certificate because she wasn't born in a hospital or the county courthouse. But I'm just saying that some people aren't born in hospitals, or the courthouse is burned down, which is the case in several places within Minnesota, then we've had to do variances. But my understanding is what they need is a photo, a picture of you to identify that you are who you say you are, either your birth certificate and either a Social Security card. I think you have to have a Social Security number I'm not sure if you have to have the card or not, but you have to give them the number. So those would be some of the things you have to do for a passport. It's very similar to what we require, except that we don't require, we allow for people that aren't citizens to be able to get a driver's license. So.
Madam Chair.
Senator Saxhog.
Two things. One, I just want to make it clear that, you know, this is kind of for all of Minnesota. The two crossings that get the most traffic, and one of them probably is not International Falls, is probably the Pigeon River crossing, which is basically Duluth to Thunder Bay, and probably those people coming from Moorhead, East Grand Forks, Thief River Falls that are going over the North Dakota border up to Winnipeg or someplace like that. They would all use this driver's license. Now, what I think is so important is we've all done this, but in Grand Rapids, which is 120 miles south of the border, there's people that go over the border every weekend, and they always have their minnows and their jigs and everything, soda pop and whatever they have. But a lot of times the problem, and you always carry a driver's license because you got to have one to drive. But, you know, carrying a passport that you might drop in the lake, I think that's what we're trying to do is simplify this for the whole state of Minnesota. However, it seems to me that most of these questions that we're getting have to do with maybe having somebody from the federal government stop by and say hello. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson's given his testimony, and that would be fine. I think Ms. McCormick and myself would be happy to come back if you'd want to table this until we get that federal person, and then it didn't seem to me that there's anything insurmountable after those answers are taken care of.
Senator Saxhog, I was going to suggest that. I did put a call in to see if we can get somebody here because I knew that there would be lots of questions on the federal documents, and we didn't have anybody, we weren't able to arrange for anyone to come. So if you're amenable to that, let's do that, because I think it'd be important to have the federal questions answered. And in the meantime, Ms. McCormick, if you could visit with Senator Higgins and Senator Limmer with the information about the specific acts, as well as the requirements by the WITI requirements, that would be helpful. Senator Saxhog, thank you. It's been a really good conversation to go through the bill, and
thank you,
we'll definitely try to see if we can get you back.
That's great. Okay? Thanks.
Mr. Anderson, thank you for the visit. And I was mistaken. It was not a tug of war. It was the tug of peace. I recall, as I was sitting here. So I correct myself for the record. Thank you for being here. Members, we're going to recess for a little biological break.
That's a new term here.
I want personal needs.
I'm sorry, I wish I could give you a little bit more time, but how about we're all back here at what? 6:30. We're all due back here at 6:30. Okay. So we are in recess.
Madam Chair, do you know that I won't be here?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You have a permanent biological.